The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's hard to imagine mixing one's national anthem with the decision to have children, but in China, the number of kids you have for decades has been a way of expressing solidarity with Chinese national political goals, the Chinese one-child policy. But the government has announced that the one-child policy is now over and that families will be permitted to have two children, a policy which has addressed China's population issues and created a number of other problems as well. It's over. We will also talk about military tensions in the South China Sea and Wednesday's GOP debate. But first, to the swirl of change in China, a naval cat-and-mouse game in the South China Sea all week long between the U.S. Navy and China, and the Chinese Communist government announcing the end of its one-child policy. Any number from 0 to 2 is now glorious, officially, says the party. Joining us is Simon Denyer, China bureau chief for The Washington Post. Simon, is this really the end of an epoch?
Absolutely. I mean, this is perhaps the greatest, the biggest population control experiment in human history. And it's not completely over. As you say, Chinese couples will still have to have two children as a maximum, no more than that. But it is the end of the one-child policy, a hugely controversial and very unpopular policy here.
Morally a failure, politically a failure, or in population terms, a failure?
Probably all three of those things. I mean, certainly morally a failure. There were brutal sterilizations and abortions. There were bribes paid to skirt the rules. The idea that officials could have control over women's bodies was morally repugnant to many people. But economically a failure too, because, you know, here we have a China where the population is aging very rapidly. The labor force is shrinking, and one-child policy has made that worse. So China's facing some real economic headwinds because of the demographics. Demographers have been calling for at least 10 years for this policy to be abandoned. The party has finally recognized that the policy needed to be abandoned. But just to restate, it hasn't completely abandoned it. It can't admit that it made a mistake. So it's still got some policy in place, a two-child policy now instead of a one-child policy.
Now, what would you say is the political implication of this cat-and-mouse game in the South China Sea? Is this nationalism actually built up as islands constructed in the South China Sea that the United States is now trying to challenge? And is it mostly for domestic consumption, or is this brewing into a superpower incident of some kind?
A bit of both, frankly. I mean, Xi Jinping is doing what he's doing because he's bolstering his domestic credentials as a nationalist, because he thinks that China genuinely ought to be more assertive on the world stage, and because he thinks that it's been walked over too long. So he wants to champion China's rights in many fields, and territorial field is one of those fields. So it is a lot to do with domestic consumption and domestic politics. But that domestic politics is also quite hard to handle, because what you saw when the U.S. sailed through the waters close to one of the islands this week was a lot of people in China going, well, why isn't China doing more to stand up to it? So once you start toying with nationalism, it's quite difficult to know, you know, where to draw the line. And in response to the second part, yes, there is a real rivalry developing between the US and China. The South China Sea is one of the main crucibles of that rivalry. It's going to have to be carefully managed. Neither side wants a confrontation. Neither side wants military escalation. But both sides are going to have to manage this rivalry quite carefully.
Is that to say that China has no option but to take out a destroyer to go to the next step? Could it box in a ship for a while? Could it actually board and stop a ship? I mean, it seems like there are very few options other than saying, get out of here.
It's very much to be seen, I think, how often the U.S. does this, whether the ships loiter, whether China starts to put a little bit more pressure. I don't think we're going to see ramming, but we could see close approaches. We could see brinkmanship. And when you get that kind of thing happening, there is, of course, the risk of accidents. There is, of course, the risk of actual contact between the ships.
China bureau chief of the Washington Post on the end of the one-child policy in China and the beginning of some brinkmanship between the U.S. and China in the South China Sea. Simon, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
So what did we learn in last night's GOP debate? This was a bit of a surprise, this detail, from a man who lives in the most gun-restrictive big city in America.
Donald. Got a gun. I have a permit.
Donald Trump.
Got a gun.
Mr. Trump.
Donald Trump.
Mr. Trump.
The whole world's come undone.
Permit to carry.
Mr. Donald Trump. Donald.
Got a gun.
And I do carry on occasion. Sometimes a lot, but I like to be unpredictable so that people don't know exactly what to carry.
Trump has a gun. How is this relevant for someone who wants to be commander-in-chief and would get a Secret Service detail, his own Marine detail, a Navy, an Army, an Air Force, as part of his job? It's a bit of a puzzle. Nate Silver tweeted it was relevant from 538. He said Trump would have shot baby Hitler. Okay. We learned that Ben Carson wants people to believe he's reasonable on the legally decided issue of same-sex marriage.
I believe that our Constitution protects everybody, regardless of their sexual orientation or any other aspect. I also believe that marriage is between one man and one woman, and that there is no reason that you can't be perfectly fair to the gay community. They shouldn't automatically assume that because you believe that marriage is between one man and one woman, that you are a homophobe.
A tweet from political scientist Ian Bremmer, Carson 16, all the crazy, none of the excitement. Ted Cruz really got folks going when he took on CNBC's questioners.
This is not a cage match. And you look at the questions. Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking about the substantive issues people care about?
Neil Irwin, economic correspondent for the New York Times, tweeted, wait, am I correct that there has been a daily fantasy sports regulation question, but not a Wall Street regulation question? This was exactly what had New Jersey Governor Chris Christie fuming.
We have $19 trillion in debt. We have people out of work. We have ISIS and Al-Qaeda attacking us. And we're talking about fantasy football?
We also learned that the two candidates from Florida, Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush, do not get along.
But Marco, when you signed up for this, this was a six-year term, and you should be showing up to work. I mean, literally, the Senate, what is it, like a French work week? You get like 3 days where you have to show up? You can campaign or just resign and let someone else take the job.
Well, let me tell you, I don't remember you ever complaining about John McCain's vote record. The only reason why you're doing it now is because we're running for the same position, and someone has convinced you that attacking me is going to help you.
Well, I've been...
Here's the bottom line. I'm not... My campaign is going to be about the future of America. It's not going to be about attacking anyone else on this stage.
Conservative commentator Michelle Malkin tweeted, good riddance, Jeb Bush. And a rare tweet from Matt Drudge, Jeb Bush can eat carbs now. And to conclude, we learned that John Kasich loves his resume.
Well, I mean, right here, to talk about we're just going to have a 10% tithe and that's how we're going to fund the government. And we're going to just fix everything with waste, fraud, and abuse. Or that we're just going to be great, or we're going to ship 10 million Americans or 10 million people out of this country, leaving their children here in this country and dividing families. Folks, we got to wake up. We cannot elect somebody that doesn't know how to do the job. You got to pick somebody who has experience.
And we learned that mixed record CEO Carly Fiorina likes capitalism. It's just crony capitalism she hates.
Crony capitalism is alive and well and has been so in Washington, D.C. for decades. What's crony capitalism? Crony capitalism is what happens when government gets so big and so powerful that only the big and the powerful can handle it.
To which Jason Musty, and CEO of Distractify, said you could caption literally any picture of Carly Fiorina with, I want to speak to the manager. And there was no manager to speak to. And ratings for the CNBC debate were down compared to the Fox and CNN debate. So perhaps Carly didn't worry about the airtime this time. We want to speak to the manager. Get in here, Todd Zwillick, takeaway Washington correspondent. You're in the House chamber where they picked a new manager today after John Boehner said goodbye. Let's listen to that, Todd.
I'm just a regular guy, humbled by the chance to do a big job.
Emotional moment, and where do we go from here?
always an emotional moment with John Boehner, isn't it? He's famous for it. And he had a box of tissues on the table behind him in the well of the House. And as the House stood and gave John Boehner a standing ovation, one of many, by the way, he picked up that box of tissues and waved it at his colleagues, sort of a joke, sort of a sop to the fact that everyone knows that John Boehner's a bit soppy when he talks about this job, and he was today, too. And so next, the manager, Paul Ryan, and we'll get to him in a second. John, this is the pinnacle of a long Capitol Hill career for a relatively young Paul Ryan, who's now the 54th Speaker of the House. He's only 45 years old, but he spent pretty much his entire professional life on Capitol Hill. I ran into Sam Brownback. Remember him? He's the governor of Kansas now. Before that, he was a senator.
Right.
Before that, he was a House member. And Paul Ryan worked for him as a very, very young staffer. Listen.
He was my first legislative director in the House and the Senate. We stuffed him in an old closet, broom closet, that was where his office was. And he was brilliant then. I thought he was too young for the job, but he proved me wrong.
Some Speaker of the House will be saying that about you someday, Todd.
Well, none of them has really gotten a chance to stuff me in a closet yet. They stuffed me in a few tight press pools, that's for sure. Paul Ryan steps to the podium, steps to the dais with Nancy Pelosi there for the passing of the gavel. He didn't have a gavel kiss for her the way John Boehner has over the years, but he does have a very fractious, divided House still, and he's looking to unify them. He's looking to start a new era in the House. He's been saying it in press releases all week. Listen to Ryan.
But let's be frank, the House is broken. We're not solving problems, we're adding to them. And I am not interested in laying blame. We are not settling scores. We are wiping the slate clean.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, he thinks the House is broken. Does the Liberty Caucus think the House is broken?
Yeah, they do. And they heard a lot of good things from new Speaker Paul Ryan from the dais in that speech. We're going to change the internal rules of the House. We're going to give the committees and individual legislators more power. Paul Ryan has promised those conservatives that he won't bring up comprehensive immigration reform this Congress unless it has a majority Republican support, which the chances of that are basically zero. We've already seen that movie with a lot of these particular members. And we're also going to give new legislating writing powers to individual members. That's all stuff they want to hear. But John, they are looking over his shoulder. John Boehner has given Paul Ryan a gift. There really isn't going to be a shutdown fight. There could be one or two, but he's taken away a lot of the ammo from the conservatives that plague John Boehner. There's not going to be a debt limit confrontation. There may be a spending confrontation, but Paul Ryan's going to have relatively smooth sailing for at least a year here, probably legislatively. Hey, I caught up with one person, though, outside the House chamber who knows a thing or two about trying to lead in a fractious Republican Party. Here's Mitt Romney. Listen.
Paul Ryan has the experience, the judgment, the lack of ego, the intelligence and the humility to reach out within his own party to people who have differing views and to reach across the aisle with people of goodwill that have differing views. And he will listen and bring those ideas to the front. And I think you'll see him be a very effective speaker.
Is he redecorating one of his houses? Is that why he's up there? His old home week there on the Hill.
Is there to see his old friend Paul Ryan. John, I'll just tell you, 9 Republicans voted against Paul Ryan in a protest vote, so it's not all smooth sailing going forward.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Mr. Manager.
You got it.
So the U.S. has finally come to the conclusion that having 2.2 million people behind bars is too many. We've reported that on the program quite a lot lately. There is a consensus to reduce that number. And so beginning on Friday, as part of new guidelines from the U.S. Sentencing Commission, 6,000 prisoners will be released from federal prisons across the country. Should we all buy guns? Are halfway houses and treatment programs ready for this? Or will it barely be noticed in terms of community tranquility? The state of California has some experience here. Responding to a judge's order to relieve overcrowding, the state finally started a public safety realignment program in 2011 to reduce the number of people in state prisons, releasing some and shifting others with shorter sentences to serve out their time in county jails. Based on that program, Californians went a step further in 2014, passing Proposition 47, expanding the first realignment and releasing about 18,000 offenders. Magnus Lofstrom is a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. He's part of the state monitoring effort to see how a release of this scale affects community safety.
We looked at county-level data to see how the number of offenders on the street, if it had any relationship with crime. We looked at state-level data, compared California to other states, and we really didn't find any evidence that violent crime went up as a result of 18,000 additional offenders on the street. We did find an effect on property crime. It was driven entirely by an increase in auto theft.
Do we know, based on the California experience, how many could be released? I mean, what if President Obama said older prisoners, we could release them tomorrow? It doesn't matter what crime they committed. I mean, 60-year-olds, 70-year-olds, 55-year-olds. Let's talk about beyond nonviolent drug offenders. This is the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. What if we reduced it by 10,000, 20,000? If we're going to use the California example, 18,000, what if we went to 60,000 nationally? Could we do that?
It all depends on, are we looking at the federal system, which holds about 200,000 offenders? 60,000 is a big drop. It does. I think it greatly and importantly depends on who we release. And if one were to focus on these older inmates who are 40, 50, or 60, they're very unlikely to commit new crimes. So that would be a strategy that would put less upward pressure on crime trends. What we've seen in California, we are kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of our incarceration reliance. And at that level, it didn't have much of an impact. So if you have the states, if we shift our focus over to the states where most people are incarcerated in state prisons and county jails, if we focus on those, there are a number of states that have very high incarceration rates. And if you made some changes to a state like Texas, for example, and you had a reduction on the same order of magnitude as California, wouldn't expect much of an impact on crime at all.
Is the lesson you need to release a lot more? Is that the public policy lesson? Or as we go down this road, is the lesson, hey, folks, look what's happening. We're already seeing police discouraged from being aggressive in law enforcement. Now we're seeing prosecutors discouraged from prosecuting because they're not going to be able to get convictions, and we have overcrowding, and it's not going to be tolerated anymore. And all of these effects on law enforcement and prosecutors feeling like they've got to slow down, that's going to have the impact on increasing crime.
We looked at this from a cost-benefit perspective to see if what time of crime preventive savings do we get from incarcerating someone. And we estimate that at the incarceration rates we're at in California, the crime preventive effect of locking up someone in state prison for an additional year, that additional offender, it prevents 1.2 property crimes, and these are auto thefts primarily, per year. And if we use some numbers on what is the cost to society of auto thefts, it puts it around $9,000. And so that's about $11,000, $12,000 in terms of the benefit of locking someone up at the incarceration rate that we saw in California at the time. The cost of locking someone up in state prison in California, which is very expensive, is around $53,000. So the crime preventive savings on incarceration is only about 23 cents on that additional dollar spent on incarceration. That tells me then that, yes, we can further reduce our reliance on incarceration. And what we should do, though, is not just focus on that, but we need to think about, well, if there are savings from these efforts, where should we put those so that we can combat the upward pressure that will be put on the crime trends as we reduce our reliance on incarceration?
Do we need to be prepared to tolerate some change in the way our communities take on these big issues?
I don't think we should accept that public safety would be challenged. I think what we need to do is just thinking about what are the efforts that we can put in place as we're moving in this direction that will counter the effects of the reduction in incarceration. I think that it's important to recognize that a release policy will have an impact immediately on the prison population and reduce some overcrowding problems there. But unless we change how we send people to prisons, we're not really solving that in the long term. So that means that it means that we have to come back and take a look at how we sentence people and how, when, and why do we send people to prison.
I have to ask you this because a senior corrections official said this on the program that I thought was so perfect and clear. And it was, you have to decide who you're mad at and who's really bad. That's the essential question of prison reform. And that the people that you're just mad at, you have to be able to suspend your emotional response to whatever it is they're doing and focus on the people who are real threats to the community. Can public reform policy on criminal justice, some of the preventive things that you've talked about, and incarceration make that distinction in your view?
I think so. I think we need to take a look at exactly that. It is who is it that we're sending to prison and what are the reasons behind that? As I said before, what we our experience is that since we've gotten to this point of a high incarceration reliance, the folks that we are locking up, those additional offenders at those higher rates, they're not particularly criminally active. It's not a particularly good way to allocate our resources. But again, as we move downward, if we reduce our reliance on incarceration, we're moving slowly towards the point where you're getting some of those offenders who are the bad ones, who need to be locked up. There's no doubt about that. There are people who need to be locked up, and we need to figure out how we effectively can determine who they are.
Magnus Lofstrom is a senior fellow for public policy at the Public Policy Institute of California. Thanks so much, Magnus.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So far, this 2015 World Series has gotten the largest TV audience in 6 years. Biggest audience of white guys in their 50s since Hee-Haw was canceled, right? That's an exaggeration, but it's been two great games between the Kansas City Royals and the New York Mets. The Mets lost again 7-1 last night, so they're down 2-0 in the series. Johnny Cueto, who looked like a cross between Ice Cube and the monster from Predator, outpitched Jacob deGrom, who looked like Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam getting bombed by beer cans at a bad concert. Despite all this entertainment value, audiences are still less than half the size they were during their peak in 1978, when over 44 million people watched the series. A lot of folks not watching were perhaps looking at the opening games of the new NBA season. A lot of the people not watching were black folks. Why hide it? Baseball has a black problem, and it's a problem for Chris Rock.
I don't care about any of this as a black guy. I care about this as a baseball fan. We don't really need baseball, but baseball needs us. Fact is, black America decides what's hot and what young people get excited about. Ask the men's golf tour or the women's tennis tour. Why don't you just ask Mitt Romney? You lose black America, you lose young America.
Chris Rock on HBO's Real Sports earlier this year. Is baseball lost in the past? Why did its historic moments of integration in the 50s and 60s fail to stick? Darren Snyder is a sports columnist for the Washington Times. Why do you think things have declined so? Is it baseball's lack of hipness? Is it baseball's constant evocation of a nostalgia that maybe African Americans aren't as excited about as some others in the audience?
There's several reasons, I believe. One, in terms of participation, the popularity of football and the ease that you can play basketball have decreased black participation. To play baseball, you need manicured fields. It's expensive. It's hard to organize. So particularly in urban areas, you see a decrease in the number of African-Americans who play the sport. In general, the sport is kind of contrary to the way society has gone now with the fast motion, the quick pace. And it's so long, it's like 6 months every day. And people's attention span is not what it used to be. We're used to a lot more bells and whistles and action.
Although Chris Rock says that African Dominicans and African Cubans have no problem with baseball, and they have no problem with manicured fields. They're willing to play the game with sticks and, you know, very few, you know, Nike-branded sports equipment.
That's true. That's true. They look at baseball like a lot of African-American youth look at football and basketball. That's their ticket out.
Finally, do you think that African-Americans, both spectators and players, and if you look at the prices and look at the numbers, just don't feel welcome in baseball? It's not like anyone's saying get lost, but it's not like anybody's saying, you know, come on in, we love you.
Well, I think that exposure is the main thing. Like I would imagine that the numbers are better than, say, NASCAR. But
yeah, and rodeo too, probably. Yeah.
Right, right. But you know, you have 162 games, so I would think that if you really wanted to get to one game in the season, that you could. It wouldn't be prohibitive. But baseball, to their credit, is trying to do some things with some academies in cities to try to introduce more youth to baseball. And the thing that baseball should be concerned about is not only losing out on potential fans, but losing out on potential great players who are forsaking their sport and choosing other sports.
I mean, Cueto could have gone to the NFL looking at him last night.
Cueto's a little short, but maybe he could have been a defensive back. I don't know.
Are you a baseball fan, Darren?
I am. I am a baseball fan. I spent 9 years at USA Today Baseball Weekly. That's when I really developed a much greater appreciation for the sport. I grew up typically mostly football and basketball, like a lot of my peers. Baseball is a little more nuanced. You do have to get a little more appreciation for, you know, the dead spots. But I did grow to appreciate it, and playoff baseball is just a whole different breed.
Darren Snyder is sports columnist for the Washington Times. Thanks so much, Darren.
Thank you very much.
Little economics lesson now. Living as we have been in this zone of near zero interest rates for most of a decade, the idea of parking money somewhere and assuring a safe appreciation has been turned on its head. Many places in the world already loan money at what's called a negative interest rate, kind of a no-brainer for the borrower, who gets to basically charge people for holding on to their money, guaranteeing that their clients would lose no more than 0.25% or 0.5% while they hold the money. And this is the argument for lenders. They can park their money and be assured that the shrinkage would be no more than this below zero interest rate. Federal Reserve Bank presidents in New York, San Francisco, and Minneapolis have already expressed support for negative interest rates. The central banks of Sweden, Denmark, and Switzerland all have negative interest rates. The consequence there has been to suck cash out of circulation because borrowing is cheaper than cash. The amount of money in circulation in Sweden, for instance, appears to have dropped by nearly 50% over the last 6 years. Consumers are not likely to encounter negative interest rates on their 18% or more credit cards here in the USA anytime soon. But another way of thinking about an ATM fee is that it is a negative interest rate for you. You're giving your money to the bank to use, but you draw out $100, and with a $3.50 fee, that's a negative 3.5% interest rate, right?
This is Nico from Chicago. I can't remember the last time I've used cash to pay for something. I mainly use a debit card for most transactions because I'm blind and there aren't any distinctions between denominations of paper money in the United States, and I don't want to get ripped off. Otherwise, I think cash is far more anonymous, a good thing in my opinion, and you feel the loss a lot more when you pay for something in cash than you do with plastic.
Fort Worth, Texas. I've not used paper money since 2008.
Hi, this is Sean from Mansfield. And I use my credit card approximately 90% of the time. Yeah, I do it because it makes it more convenient, and I get a record of 90% of my expenses. But in places like sub shops or variety stores, I'll tend to use cash. But otherwise, I try to stick to a credit card.
Now, as we've stipulated, a credit card is not cheaper than cash in a negative interest rate sense, as we were talking about earlier. But this idea that cash is not preferred is an interesting issue going forward. Claire Barrett is the editor of the Financial Times Money column. She agrees. She's already mostly cashless. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Why do negative interest rates tend to pull cash out of circulation?
This all became a big issue in the UK when Andy Haldane, he's the chap who's the chief economist at the Bank of England, did a speech. And he suggested the idea of having negative interest rates in the UK, but said if we did introduce this, the problem would be that everyone in Britain would go to the cash point. We don't have to pay on our ATM fees in this country, withdraw all of their cash and keep it under the mattress to avoid being charged a negative interest rate. They just hoard it. So he said instead we should introduce a government digital backed currency to get around that problem. And that got me thinking about how I use cash and contactless payments, which have come in here quite recently, up to the value of £30, about $40 or so. We can just pay by tapping a card. We don't even have to type in our PIN number. So it's becoming really, really easy to pay for things that we would have paid for in cash, or even things that we might have paid for traditionally on a debit card, by just swiping. And Apple Pay, another big invention, also uses this contactless technology. So I had two thoughts. Number one, the fact that cash is being drawn out of society and is less a feature of our everyday lives. And number two, the ease of electronic payments. Is this actually making us spend more money without realizing it?
Would you say that in a negative interest rate economy, it's cheaper to borrow than it is to use cash?
Well, if you need to borrow to get something, you know, whether you're buying a property and you need to borrow on a mortgage, or maybe you're thinking about buying a car and you need a loan to do that, then it's a really, really great time for you at the moment, because providing you've got a good enough credit record to get that line of credit, then the interest that you'll pay will be very low. But the opposite problem for most of us is that we do have cash that we've earned, or we're looking for a place to invest it where we're going to get a return on our money. So we don't really want to be borrowing more of it to spend on things that we don't need.
And would you agree that an ATM fee is essentially a negative interest rate for deposits in your checking account?
Well, essentially it is. And if you're living in this country, in the UK, then you don't have to contend with the fees for taking money out, because our system is completely different. We have a free checking account service across the UK, which Americans may be quite pleased to hear about.
Now, you keep bragging about this, and I'm inclined to denounce my citizenship.
The nasty thing about that system is that effectively our banking, our retail banking industry, is funded by issuing fines and charges to the poorer people in society who use an overdraft without prior authorization, or who want to borrow money over the short term, which lots of people say is morally the wrong way of doing things, and that we should follow Europe and America into having a banking system whereby you're paying for the services you use. But regardless, that's just how it works. Now, I did a little experiment, which I wrote about in my FT Money column a few months ago, when Andy Haldane had done this speech, and I decided that I was going to try and just use cash for 2 weeks to spend on all of my essential purchases and see what that would do to my spending. And do you know, I did spend a lot less money, because it is incredibly hard to predict how much cash you're going to need. I was forever drawing money out of the cash point so that I would have enough on me. Months later, I'm still finding, you know, bills crumpled in the back of trouser pockets and in the pockets of handbags, where I had thought I really don't want to be in a situation where I'm caught without cash. I was on a train during the experiment, and they actually had to make an announcement on the train that they couldn't take debit cards in the restaurant car, and everyone else was groaning because nobody had any cash on them apart from me, because I was doing this experiment. But it just shows to underline how much things have changed in the last generation. I mean, certainly my parents, when they were younger, they used to budget by putting money into envelopes. They'd get paid and they'd immediately separate the cash into an envelope so that they knew what they had to spend week by week, and it was a very effective way for them of keeping track of their spending. Whereas nowadays, we're all on credit cards, we're doing in-app purchases, and money is kind of becoming this less physical, more imaginary fantasy type thing that we can't really get our heads around. And I think this is why a lot of people, especially young people, do get into such big financial difficulties, because they simply can't keep track of their spending and budget.
Well, Claire, thanks so much. And one more thing, can you change a £20 note for me?
I've left my wallet at home today, I'm afraid. left the old wallet in the Maserati, dear boy.
Oh, yeah. Claire Barrett is an editor of FT Money. Her column, the Money column, you can read in the FT. Claire Barrett, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we sure wish we had some cash for you to take with you. Some of our friends might be able to help or not.
Laura Tucker from Colts Neck, New Jersey. It's not uncommon that I have no cash in my wallet, but it is slightly embarrassing to pay for small things with a credit card. Certainly not everyone is cashless, though. I recently had to pay the balance of some carpentry work, $1,200. I asked the man if he needed a check before I could finish asking, or do you take a credit card? He answered, unless you have cash, I need to pay my helper. I nearly laughed out loud.
Lynn, Massachusetts. Yesterday, I used cash to pay for groceries. My dad always told me to have a stash of cash. I didn't at one point think it was necessary. However, when he pointed out the possibility of power outages and such, I agreed. When New York was hit by that hurricane, it really reinforced the idea. Now I keep a spare $100 bill for emergencies. Worcester, Ohio. Not often do I use real money anymore, paper form anyhow. If I've made a smaller purchase and have cash in my pocket, I usually hold on to it just in case I should need it for something and use the bank card instead. But I think I end up using the cash for sneaky purchases like McDonald's and candy. Fast food money laundering, we call that. Give us your take. Tell us a story at 8778-MY-TAKE and send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And subscribe to our podcast, won't you? You can find us on iTunes. Just take The Takeaway with you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.